Radio, I'm Paul Kengor. Check out my latest book, Takedown, on the sabotaging of family and marriage.
Radio for Catholic and other Christians. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
This is D.L. Hudson. Welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. My guest today is Jim Tuohy. Jim is in his sixth year as president of Ave Maria University. As most people know, a Catholic university in and about Naples, Florida. It's actually about, what, Jim, about 20 miles inland from Naples? Is that right?
That's about right, 20, 25.
I've been there a number of times. Beautiful campus, great faculty, and obviously a great president. Jim and I met some years ago when he served under President George W. Bush as director of the Faith-Based Initiative, which was a very important and creative way that the Bush administration sought to help support faith-based initiatives in helping the poor and healthcare and education in all kinds of important ways. As President Bush used to say, the government cannot love, but he definitely put some money in the hands of people who do love. And Jim Tuohy administered that program, and we're not going to talk about what's happened to it since then because I've got Jim on the phone to talk about something very happy, and that is this coming Sunday in the Vatican, a personal friend of his that he was the legal counsel to for 12 years will be canonized in Rome, Mother Teresa of Calcutta. Jim, we've talked about this before, but I think it's worth repeating. How did you meet Mother Teresa of Calcutta?
Well, Dale, it was improbable to say the least. I was working for a U.S. senator then, Mark Hatfield of Oregon, and he was chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee.
Wasn't he a Democrat?
No, he was a liberal Republican, pro-life Republican, but he voted against every defense bill. But yeah, he was. But strangely enough, Dale, this Southern Baptist was friends with Mother Teresa. He and Antoinette, his wife, had met Mother in Vellore, India, back in the early 70s when Mother was unknown. And he saw something special and stayed in touch with her. And so when she won the Nobel Peace Prize and subsequently, he maintained contact with her. And in fact, when one of Mother's trips to Washington, she went by and had lunch in his office with all the staff. So I mean, there was that friendship. And when I was being sent overseas on a trip, I wanted to meet her. And so I thought, well, heck, on the way back, maybe I can drop in and meet her and take a letter in from Senator Hatfield. And that's what I did in August of 1985 and got to meet Mother, and it was life-changing.
And she kind of handed you a bucket, right?
She said to go to my home for the dying and ask for Sister Luke. And I thought, you know, because I hadn't been there, and she asked me if I had. And I said,
and you were just going for a friendly visit, right?
Yeah, I thought I was going to get a tour. I thought that's what Mother said, go check it out like a tourist. I had no interest in helping, none, zero.
So you were sent to a certain bed to care for a patient, is that correct?
Yeah, Sister Luke meets me right when I walk in, and I introduce myself, and then she goes, well, I'm glad you came. Here's some medicine, and here's some cotton, and go clean this guy in bed 46 that has scabies. And I was too proud to admit to her that I didn't want to touch the guy, and I couldn't say, well, I'd love to help, but I have to leave. So because of my pride, I ended up walking back to that bed.
And had you ever seen scabies?
No. I actually had to ask a volunteer there what they looked like. And then I started to clean the guy. And he, in fact, I sat down on his leg. They had these cots lined up on this side as you enter is the men's side, and there are 50 men there on cots. And this guy was so emaciated that I didn't see a leg under the blanket, and I sat on it.
Oh, Lord.
I was kind of numb. It was a strange experience because I was going back to do something that was so far outside my comfort zone, but I was too proud to tell her, you've got to be kidding me, I don't want to do that.
How did you feel after you had done that?
Well, I felt, there was no angelic music, and there was certainly no, and where, you know, Mother spoke of the poor as Jesus in his distressing disguise, and it was only later that I grew to discover Jesus was waiting for me in that bed. But there was a barrier crossed when I did that, because I'd never done something like that before, and I was, 28 years old. So then I helped feed a person or two to where I had stayed, probably a total of 30 minutes in the house. And once I'd been there long enough, then I got out. And, so I was anxious to get out of there. But then when I got to Hawaii, I was as uncomfortable there as I'd been in Calcutta. So, it was
kind of like T.S. Eliot's Journey of the Magi. And they leave, they leave seeing the baby Jesus. And I forget the exact line, but they say, no longer comfortable in Zion.
Yeah.
So your life got pretty shook up then.
Yeah, it did. And when I got, because I talked myself into going to India, saying, okay, I'll go in and out of there one day to meet Mother, and then I'll go to Hawaii on the way home. And so there I was on the beaches of Hawaii now, and in paradise, you'd say, and I was as uncomfortable there as I'd been. I mean, the pineapples were healthier than the people I'd just left, and they were watering the yard of the hotel, and I'd just seen people struggling. I mean, India back 30 years ago was vastly different and vastly poor, much less Western money, worse infrastructure. I can't even imagine what it was like when Mother started out.
Yeah, I remember my parents went there. My parents went there once, and they could not describe the horror that they saw in the streets of Calcutta. Yeah. Now, fast forward, how did you become a personal friend of Mother Teresa, who's soon to be saint, and her legal advisor?
It was just, again, the mercy of God. When I got back to the U.S., I went and saw her sisters because Mother had asked me to do that. I didn't even know she had sisters in Washington. So I went by and saw them and brought Mother's greetings, and they said, well, why don't you come and help Saturday? And so I was single at the time, and I got hooked on helping the sisters. And so I was then just unpacking a lot of the Calcutta experience, and the sisters were great at telling me how to do that. So now I was deep into weekly adoration and mass and all these things that were now helping me and discover what God had given me. So Mother was also opening AIDS homes, and she had permitting issues with the soup kitchen. There were just a lot of either legal or governmental affairs issues, and so I was there at the right place at the right time. It was just providential. And so Mother was coming back to the U.S. She came that October to do Jan Petrie's film, Mother Teresa, at the United Nations. And so I saw Mother there. And then when Mother came back a few months later, the sisters put me to work in deal. And they knew that I didn't have anything else to do besides work. And so all my free time was spent with them.
And everybody who's listening, and let me remind them that I'm talking to Jim Tooley, president of Ave Maria University in Naples, Florida, once worked for President Bush, before that worked for Mother Teresa, blessed Mother Teresa, soon to be saint. By the time this show is heard on Sunday, she will be a saint. What was it like to be around her?
Well, she was extraordinary, Deal. I mean, I met her the week she turned 75, so I knew her the last 12 years of her life. Off and on, I'd see her. She just brought out the best in people. I mean, to be around her, she was everything I wasn't. And so she had this tremendous focus and cheerfulness and seriousness. They all resided together, and she was very. There was an urgency to the work for the poor, and she was a woman of prayer, so that always came first. If you drove her somewhere, you know, she would want to pray the rosary, and she. But she also was very grounded in the world. She was very pragmatic. She loved life. She wasn't one of these ethereal beings floating around a room that we sometimes turn our saints into. She loved her nuns. She loved her sweets, you know. It was just lovely. It was lovely to be. When you read in Scripture where, you know, when Peter says, it's good to be here with you, you know, and there was that feeling. It was just good to be with Mother.
You know, it reminds me of the time so precious to me that I spent with Father Benedict Rochelle. I mean, he just lifted everybody, and
yeah.
He lifted you toward being your better self.
Yeah.
But he made it effortless.
Yeah.
Like it was right there.
Holiness does that, I think.
Yeah, and I've been in the presence, I think, of maybe three holy people, and they all have that. They have this ordinary joy of life plus this supercharged energy that seems to come from them. I don't mean to sound New Age.
Are you talking about George Bush?
No. Good man, but not a saint. Now, you've done great things at Ave Maria University in your 6 years. You've tripled the number of majors to 33. You've added nursing, education, accounting, biochemistry. You've raised a whole bunch of millions of dollars. But you have a Mother Teresa project, which is apropos for us to talk about right now.
Well, when Tom Monahan founded Ave Maria University, and of course Tom is legendary among Catholics, really within the whole world of philanthropy for what he did. And, you know, and he was doing this before it became fashionable to give out.
Yes.
You know,
great man.
Well,
great man.
But one of the when I arrived on the campus here, when I was being considered as for the presidency, I was struck that one of the dorms was Mother Teresa Hall. You know, there was an existing devotion. The other and the twin dorm next to it was John Paul II. This is before both of them had been canonized or beatified. I guess Mother had been beatified, but it was.
Well, we were there for that.
Yeah, that's right.
Together.
There.
Yeah, sitting next right next to the Holy Father.
2003.
That's right.
And so the university already had this clear devotion to Mother Teresa, which Tom started. And so because I had that relationship with the sisters since 1985, I spoke with Sister Prema, who's a superior general. I just said, Sister, you know, the Franciscans honor St. Francis through their universities in Steubenville and other places. And the you know, the Holy Cross Fathers, the Ignatians, honor St. Ignatius. You know, you look down the different, you know, congregations and the saints that, you know, that they were inspiration for the charism of. I said, who's going to do Mother Teresa? Who's going to introduce, you know, her to college kids? And so they saw that we were small and little, I guess, and so they gave us this permission to start the Mother Teresa Project. So we've been in our third year.
So you have hundreds of your students that have gone to India and other places to work with them.
Yeah, we go wherever the missionaries of charity, Mother Teresa's nuns, need volunteers. And so we.
And what kind of impact do the students report having when they come back?
Oh, my gosh, Dale. It's amazing to read their letters and to see them actually on the campus come back. And then to watch them a year after that and the next year after that. It's just the Lord really does, it really does bring fecundity to their lives if they let them. So, Mary, my wife, takes a group to Haiti. She'll do that again this year to the sisters in Port-au-Prince. And we're going to have trips this year to Guatemala. We're going to Africa for the first time.
I bet nobody messes with Mary.
Tell
her I said that.
I will tell her that.
Now, of course, you know firsthand the kind of impact working with the poor. I know that Father Gauchel used to tell me, Deal, if you want to meet real joy, hang out with the poor.
Yeah.
And they, you will be very surprised at what you find. But, of course, you're not only hanging out with the poor, you're hanging out with the suffering and the destitute, and you're bringing them something that they desperately need.
I'll tell you, Dale, the Ave Maria University students amaze me, that they are willing to dive into the deep end and do this work that is just humanly... I would never have done it at that age. No way.
Well, you didn't want to do it when you were 28. You kind of got stuck.
I was thrown in off the high drive.
You showed up for dinner and you were put to work.
It's pretty true.
You know, and of course,
I remember in my mind that day, Dale, that I was thinking, how am I going to go back and explain? You know, I brought scabies back, you know, like, hey, I've got scabies.
I bet Senator Hatfield just had a great time hearing this story.
He did. He laughed heartily over the whole thing. He thought it was hilarious.
And
but he did.
But, you know, young people at that age, they're idealists, and they're willing, they're disposed to do great things if the opportunity presents itself.
That's so true. That's so true.
I mean, they believe in the ideals that grown-ups say they believe in, but don't necessarily strive toward anymore. They get older people get cynical and they get tired, beaten down, and so forth.
Right. I think people do get discouraged, and that's why I love that John Paul II, Mother's great friend, always, you know, began his pontificate with, you know, be not afraid, and telling these young people, you know, and we had a bunch of our students at World Youth Day. And they came back, you know, just on fire, because there is that world telling you to be fearful, and the students want to give their lives to something much bigger than themselves. And I see so many Ave Maria kids grow when they get involved in the Mother Teresa Project.
I bet you thought of those words, be not afraid, after you took over the presidency of Ave Maria University.
Yeah.
Any school, especially a small Catholic school, is going to have its challenges.
Yeah, we have. It's been, you know, Dale, one of the things Mother Teresa once said, because one of the things I did for her as a lawyer was protect her, the use of her name and prohibit people from fundraising. And the reason she said she didn't fundraise is, quote, that she preferred the insecurity of divine providence. The insecurity of divine providence,
wow,
which we live down here at Ave Maria. Some universities depend on their big endowments or their storied traditions. But Tom Monahan just, you know, came to these tomato fields down in Southwest Florida and transformed it into this beautiful campus, $300 million later, into this beautiful campus. So, yeah, it's...
And it is beautiful. Our listeners should know that this campus and town, Ave Maria, that lies 20-odd miles inland from Naples, is a stunning place. And it has a great sense of holiness, a great sense of community, and anyone who's in the Naples area, and certainly anyone who has a high school student looking for college, should certainly look into Ave Maria. And the faculty there, Jim, under you, I've watched silently, not saying anything to you, but your faculty has grown steadily stronger these years.
Yeah, it really has, Steele. Thanks for saying that. And the faculty really has been, talk about not being afraid to come down here, buy houses that then immediately go underwater when the housing boom pops. And the school, you know, it's fragile and young, and so there's that insecurity, and they stuck with it. And they're carrying degrees from some of the most elite schools in the country, Harvard and Yale and so forth.
That's right.
They stay here to teach because they love the kids and they want to practice their faith.
It's funny how true teachers love teaching, and they'll put up with a lot of, you know, a lot of obstacles to do that. But you're going to be there at the canonization on Sunday, and you're taking a whole bunch of people. Tell us about that.
Well, we're going to have a little over 30 of our students, and then some alums and others that are all joining up, and I'll be bringing a group of our trustees and their spouses and other friends of the university.
Are you thinking 70 or 80 people?
Yeah, about that, which for a little school is a pretty mighty show.
Yeah.
Some colleges that have study abroad programs in Rome that might have a good delegation, but this is Ave coming over there just for 4 days, you know.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a great time of grace, and there's just a real love of Mother Teresa and an awareness of how unique this is. I mean, think about it, Deal. I don't know what the number would be, but there haven't been many saints that were canonized on such a fast track. You know, Jose Maria Escrivá, maybe the Little Flower is 28 years. Mother's now 19 years. John Paul, of course. Yeah, but that's a recent phenomenon. So, you know, for people that got to watch Mother from near or afar, to see her canonized in their lifetimes, that's a moving experience, I think.
Well, you know, Bill Donahue recently published, in fact, just a week or so ago, a book defending Mother Teresa against her critics, Christopher Hitchens. I had him on the show last week, and, he reminded me that when Time Magazine did a poll of the most admired people in the world in the 20th century, Mother Teresa came out on top.
Yeah. Yeah, she was beloved by people of all, you know, faiths and wherever they stood in life, they rich or poor, it didn't matter. There was an admiration that she was authentic. You see so many people pretending to be something that it was just unmistakable that she walked the talk.
Did you happen to be at the prayer breakfast when she spoke her famous speech in front of the Clintons?
Oh, yeah.
You were there.
Yeah.
Oh, you got to tell us about that.
Well, the run-up to the prayer breakfast was interesting because there was, a concern that they were going to use the images of Mother there with the Clintons to, you know, for political reasons or whatever, because Mother hadn't met the Clintons yet, and he was 2 years into his presidency, and she had known the other U.S. presidents before them, so they were anxious to have a meeting set up, and so that was set up for after the speech. Mother gets up in that speech, makes it just a full-throated endorsement of life, and saying that if someone doesn't want the baby, give the baby to me, and President Clinton and Mrs. Clinton are sitting to her right, 5 feet away. And then Mother went to back after the talk was over. She met with the Clintons privately, and Sandy McMurtry was there with Mother. And
she was in that meeting.
She was, because she wanted to make sure that the terms of the meeting were honored, which meant no photos. And so that.
Are you free to share what happened in that meeting?
Well, I wasn't there, but the.
But Sandy told you.
There's fear of God and there's fear of Sandy.
Okay. I understand.
Yeah, not that.
But I'm sure the message was consistent.
But Mother, got to know Mrs. Clinton. I don't know that she ever met with President Clinton again, but she did see Mrs. Clinton. In fact, Mrs. Clinton led the delegation, the U.S. delegation, to Mother's funeral. And I was on that plane because somehow I ended up in the delegation, the U.S. delegation that went. There were 12 people. And a lot of them were these political appointee types, and John Lewis was on the plane. But there were also lovely people like Eunice Shriver. She was in the delegation.
Right.
And so Mrs. Clinton was leading it. And as you recall, this is a week after the Princess Diana funeral and all of that. And so, but I think Mrs. Clinton was moved by Mother and her life. And,
that would be another proof of her sanctity. I mean, that's not to single her out, but I mean, that's right. What saints do is that they get to, that's what, I mean, I've heard stories about Padre Pio and others who just, they get to the tough ones.
I genuinely, truly believe that Mrs. Clinton loved Mother. I do. I think I just watched her.
Yeah.
I was with, when the two of them were together once in 1995, they opened up this home for adoption together there on Western Ave in D.C. And I watched them together, and, Mother just had a tremendous maternal love for people. And I think for someone like Hillary Clinton that had seen everything under the sun, seeing a Mother Teresa that was so unmistakably authentic, it had to impress her.
You know, we got 3 minutes left in this segment. How does a nun from Albania, of all places, get to be Mother Teresa?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, how does a man from Vatovice become Pope. You know, you look at the interplay of these two people coming from such obscure origins, and it just shows that nothing is impossible with God. I think you look at Mother and just from a deal, you know, maybe we'll have more time to talk about it, but just if you ponder for a second, how does this woman start a worldwide missionary order, and she goes home to God, and it's you know, 47 years old, and it's in over 100 countries. I mean, and it's thousands of women. I mean, how did she do that?
And she never asked for money.
Right. I mean, the big multinational corporations, they have language programs to, you know, they do all the MBA training. How did she start a religious order out of nothing but a bunch of schoolgirls that she taught in that Loreto convent? And that's why it really is, it's whatever imagery you want from Scripture and from Jesus' life, multiplying the loaves and fish or any of the extraordinary miracles, you could apply it to this improbability of how Mother did what she did at the time she did it.
Don't you think it proves the fact that in each of us there is a desire to be a saint, and when you have the opportunity, when you're confronted with holiness, that it just pulls that part to the surface?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think she fanned into flame a lot of people that came in contact with her with weak faith, that she would take that little flicker and fan it, because she was all for Jesus through Mary. I mean, she would write that on all her letters, and, you know, that was just almost her signature, all for Jesus through Mary. And she thought of herself as just this humble pencil in the hand of God that he wrote love letters to the world with. Those were her words. She just said, you know, if she'd been more humble, God would have done even bigger things. So she was aware that God was doing, she would have had to have been blind not to notice this.
Jim Tuohy, president of Ave Maria University, former personal friend and legal advisor to Blessed Mother Teresa of Calcutta. We'll be back right after this short message.
Hi, Tom Lowy here, Development Director for Ave Maria Radio. Our fall membership drive is September 6th through the 9th this year. That's the week of Labor Day, and we really need volunteers to make this drive successful. If you can spare a couple of hours during any of the days of the drive, that's September 6th through the 9th, give us a call at 877-288-1077 or email our volunteer director, Cheryl, by going to volunteer@avemariaradio.net.
Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I am Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, the liturgical life of the Church calls us to something that is vital to both the rhythms of our lives and to worship. It is a spirituality of preparation, which even has its very own rite.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO, Ave Maria Radio.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchuk.
We all know that consistency is important for our children's well-being, but a recent study in the Journal of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry shows just how true that is. Researchers found that young children who experienced multiple moves and school changes had up to a 60% greater risk for exhibiting serious mental health problems in adolescence, including psychosis. Consistency in a child's life isn't just key, it's critical. Our church teaches us that human beings need ritual to be healthy and happy. Rather than being boring, repetitious actions, rituals bring order, meaning, and peace to our daily lives. Multiple moves and school changes disrupt the rituals that allow children to develop the ability to regulate their emotional, psychological, and relational lives. To give your kids an advantage, work hard to keep up rituals like family meals, game nights, family prayer, family days, and, of course, Sunday Mass as a family. I'm Dr. Greg Popchuk, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
I am back with Jim Tuohy, president of Ave Maria University in Naples, Florida. Great place. You should put it on your list of great Catholic colleges when it comes to encouraging anyone to consider a college. And he was a personal friend of Mother Teresa, Blessed Mother Teresa, soon to be a saint. He's going to the Vatican tomorrow, taking 80 good people with him, going to be there for the canonization. You know, one thing, Jim, I wanted to ask you, when you think of this amazing journey from being a nun in Albania to becoming the head of this worldwide order of sisters, did you ever get the sense that Mother Teresa had an extraordinary intelligence in addition to sanctity?
Yes. She not only had intelligence, and she was very well-read, and this is someone, of course, with no college education whatsoever. She had a bit of nurse training in Patna but she'd been teaching for 17 years. So other than what the instruction she got through the Loreto sisters, her formal education was very modest. But she had this native intelligence and incredible wisdom and judgment that she sized up people and situations. She didn't read newspapers, but she knew what was going on in the world. It was uncanny. I don't know how else to describe watching her in meetings, making decisions, reading people, when to press, when not to press. Because a lot of the work she did was, you know, had opposition. People didn't want shelters in their neighborhoods, or they, you know, even when she was going to give the National Prayer Breakfast speech, how to thread that needle. So yeah, she was an extraordinary woman. And then I was in Tijuana recently at the Mother Teresa Center, Tijuana, Mexico, and Sister Rosanna there was showing me the library of Mother's books, and she was an incredible reader. These were deep books. They weren't just, you know, kind of pop spirituality. Mother read deep stuff. So yeah, I think she had quite a native intelligence that served her well.
And of course, the diaries, spiritual diaries of Mother Teresa, when they were published, I guess by her spiritual director, is that right?
Well, Father Brian published them, but they were submitted as part of the beatification process. All these letters and things that priests had kept of hers.
And she, so internally, spiritually, she had a very rough journey herself.
Yep, it's that she wrote of the darkness she was experiencing and feeling forsaken and abandoned, and unlike the John of the Cross experience or Teresa of Avila and those that have reported the so-called dark night of the soul, hers lasted 50 years.
It's such a powerful story that, you know, I'll have to have you back sometime to talk just about that. But what it tells you is that she did all she did with evidently great joy and cheerfulness and providing of strength to others, while she had a kind of spiritual dryness inside.
That's right. That's right. I mean, when you were with Mother, you saw how hard she drove herself. I mean, I was with her when she was in her 80s. And she gets up at 4:40 every morning, and then she's out the door when she's visiting cities. They've got everything planned for her, so she goes to her Mass and her prayer. But then by 7:30, she's out the door, and she's going to have a full day of events because she really felt like she could spread the gospel and go places that the Holy Father couldn't go. And so you'd get her back to the house, and I'd be exhausted. It'd be 9:30 at night. She'd have a line of people waiting to see her, her sisters that were in the convent waiting for one-on-one time, which she would do. So we all saw how hard she pushed herself, even when she was sick. I remember in Memphis just holding her hand. It was burning with fever. She just pushed herself. But we all thought she was getting these sweet consolations, you know, that God was whispering these things in her ear to assure her. And to learn after her death, and to the surprise of even her close friends like Sister Nirmala, that in fact it was the opposite, and she was getting nothing. To this day, that's wrapped in such mystery, it's beyond my intelligence.
So as you go back, you were there for the beatification. Now you're going back for the canonization. How do you expect that you'll feel sitting there while Pope Francis performs this act?
You know, sitting here now for this interview, you just begin to start to think about that, and it's overwhelming. Yeah. It's just an overwhelming thought. It's the mercy of God and how much the church needs, Mother, with all this religious rivalry and strife and just...
It is a tough time for our country and for Catholics, isn't it?
Yeah, and she understood religious freedom better than we do because she was living in a Hindu country with a large Muslim population. Christianity is a sliver. And so, you know, to see this all taking place in God's time, it's overwhelming. So I'm going to try not to think about it.
Well, don't be, you know, don't cry like a baby like you did last time.
I was going to say, you know, tissues or Depends or something. I don't know. It's going to be overwhelming, you know.
Are your five kids going?
No, but the two of the children that didn't meet her, the three older children met Mother. The two that didn't are going with Mary.
Wonderful.
And me.
Wonderful. And Mary's going?
Oh, yeah. Mary's the first ticket on that one. Mother loved Mary, and Mary, you know, it was beautiful when they were together. And when we got engaged, we gave our first wedding invitation, handed it to Mother. It was in December of 1991, and Mother asked one of the sisters where she would be, and she wasn't going to be in the United States. And so she said, oh, well, then I'll send my sisters. And at our wedding deal, we had 30 or 35 sisters singing, and nobody remembers anything about my wedding other than the sisters. So,
well, that's
to have them there.
You can't compete with the nuns. Let's face it. And then you've got a saintly one to boot. And don't tell me how many other saints there are in that order.
Oh my gosh! But look at the martyrs out of Yemen. You know,
yes.
And yesterday in Argentina, where the sisters were beaten and they tried to rob the convent, and they ransacked it, and all they found was the equivalent of $4. That's how the sisters live. They found $4.
And yet people like Christopher Hitchens, while he was alive, and some others that are still alive, kept accusing her and her order of lack of transparency and
right.
You know, all this kind of nonsense. And when they finally got into her bank account, they found $7 million, and as you and I both know, that's nothing when it comes to looking at the kind of organization that she was running.
Yeah, 130 countries? Come on. I mean, people love to look from afar. They have eyes and they can't see, and so they want to project all of their problems with faith in God, and Mother loved them. I remember Mother once saying, she asked me why Christopher Hitchens wrote that book. She just said, why would he say such things? And then she just said, we must pray for him. And she
yeah.
meant it. And it wasn't like a throw line.
He was a tortured soul.
Yeah, poor guy. May he rest in peace. But a mother prayed for him, so there's hope, huh?
You're going to have to leave for another important matter here in a minute. But I want you to just take this last minute and tell our listeners what a prospective student would meet coming down to go to Ave Maria University in Naples.
Thank you, Gil. This is a lovely invitation for me to tell you how much I love it down here at Ave Maria. What they would meet is a student body in love with Jesus Christ. Maybe we get 10% of students that are sent here for us to fix, but the critical mass of kids on our campus... And we love that, by the way. But the critical mass of kids on our campus, it's a positive peer influence. So it's a favorable moral climate. It's vibrantly Catholic and authentically so. First-class faculty with degrees from some of the greatest colleges and universities in the country that wanted to have an opportunity to live their faith and to teach and lead students toward the truth. A community that is very supportive. Of course, we have all the intercollegiate athletics, and about 40% of our students play in intercollegiate sports, but we also have 24/7 in Eucharistic adoration. Hundreds of students sign up for an hour. There's a lot of activities going on, and of course, the Mother Teresa Project we're very proud of. So, the Ave Maria, you asked me for a minute. Ave Maria University is a little young university that God's blessing, and that's growing. And people are starting to hear about it. So it took time, and and a lot of faith from Tom Monahan. I just admire Tom for what he started here, and now I've watched all these other people who didn't go here who've supported us so generously, and they've helped build this lovely little Catholic university and deal. It's got a golf course nearby, Panther Club.
I know. I'll come be your volunteer golf coach. And, by the way, I have a son who's, you know my son Cyprian, you've met him.
Yep.
He's going to do a year in the community college here in Virginia, but when he's done, we're going to come down and see you. You're at the top of our list for him.
Good, we want him here. That's not just because we're the A's either. You got to, we don't, those other schools, you don't want them at. You want them at Ave. So we've
That's right. And so I want our listeners to know, we've been talking to President Jim Tooley of Ave Maria University. He's on his way with approximately 80 people to go to the canonization of Blessed Mother Teresa of Calcutta. Jim, we'll all be thinking of you and wishing we were there with you. I hope you'll pray for all of us while you're there.
You're a dear friend, Dale. I sure will. And God bless you. I will look forward to the chance for us to be together soon, and we'll compare notes.
You got it. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Dale.
Now, we have a few more minutes left on the show, and what I'd like to do is to share with you some of the speech that we were discussing with Jim Tooley that he was present for in 1994 when Mother Teresa spoke at the National Prayer Breakfast in Washington, D.C., and this was during the first term in office of President Bill Clinton and First Lady Hillary Clinton. And I'd like to go to the part of the speech where she talks about abortion. So I'm going to read to you from that speech. In the previous paragraph, by the way, she had talked about the drug problem in the West, especially about young people's problems with addiction. And then she says this, "But I feel that the greatest destroyer of peace today is abortion, because it is a war against the child, a direct killing of the innocent child, murder by the mother herself." Now remember that she's sitting just a few seats away from the Clintons. "And if we accept that a mother can kill even her own child, how can we tell other people not to kill one another? How do we persuade a woman not to have an abortion? As always, we must persuade her with love, and we remind ourselves that love means to be willing to give until it hurts. Jesus gave even his life to love us. So the mother who is thinking of abortion should be helped to love. That is, to give until it hurts her plans or her free time, to respect the life of her child. The father of that child, whoever he is, must also give until it hurts. By abortion, the mother does not learn to love, but kills even her own child to solve her problems. And by abortion, the father is told that he does not have to take any responsibility at all for the child he has brought into the world. That father is likely to put other women into the same trouble. So abortion just leads to more abortion. Any country that accepts abortion is not teaching people to love, but to use any violence to get what they want. This is why the greatest destroyer of love and peace is abortion. Many people are very, very concerned with the children of India, with the children of Africa, where quite a few die of hunger and so on. Many people are also concerned about the violence in this great country of the United States. These concerns are very good. But often these same people are not concerned with the millions who are being killed by the deliberate decision of their own mothers. And this is what the greatest destroyer of peace today, abortion, which brings people to such violence. And for this I appeal in India and I appeal everywhere. Let us bring the child back. The child is God's gift to the family. Each child is created in the special image and likeness of God for greater things to love and to be loved. In this year of the family, we must bring the child back to the center of our care and concern. This is the only way that our world can survive, because our children are the only hope for the future. As older people are called to God, only their children can take their places. But what does God say to us? He says, even if a mother could forget her child, I will not forget you. I have carved you in the palm of my hand. We are carved in the palm of his hand. That unborn child has been carved in the hand of God from conception and is called by God to love and to be loved. Not only now in this life, but forever. God can never forget us. I will tell you something beautiful. We are fighting abortion by adoption, by care of the mother and adoption of her baby. We have saved thousands of lives. We have sent word to the clinics, to the hospitals and police stations. Please don't destroy the child. We will take your child. So we always have something to tell mothers in trouble. Come, we will take care of you. We will get a home for your child. And we have a tremendous demand from couples who cannot have a child. But I never give a child to a couple who have done nothing not to have a child, or done anything not to have a child. Jesus said, anyone who receives a child in my name receives me. By adopting a child, these couples receive Jesus. But by aborting a child, a couple refuses to receive Jesus. And Mother Teresa in 1994 goes on to say, please don't kill the child. I want the child. Please give me the child. I am willing to accept any child who would be aborted and to give that child to a married couple who will love the child and be loved by the child. From our children's home in Calcutta alone, we have saved over 3,000 children from abortion. These children have brought such love and joy to their adopting parents and have grown up so full of love and joy. And I might add, as an adopted dad of a young man from Romania, I say amen to that. She goes on, I know that couples have to plan their family, and for that there is natural family planning. The way to plan the family is natural family planning, not contraception. In destroying the power of giving life through contraception, a husband or wife is doing something to their self. This turns the attention to self, and so it destroys the gift of love in him or her. In loving, the husband and wife must turn the attention to each other, as happens in natural family planning, and not to self, as happens in contraception. Once that living love is destroyed by contraception, abortion follows very easily. I also know that there are great problems in the world, that many spouses do not love each other enough to practice natural family planning. We cannot solve all the problems of the world, but let us never bring in the worst problem of all, and that is to destroy love. This is what happens when we tell people to practice abortion and contraception. The poor are very great people. They can teach us so many beautiful things. Once one of them came to thank us for teaching her natural family planning and said, you people who have practiced chastity, you are the best people to teach us natural family planning, because it is nothing more than self-control out of love for each other. And what this poor person said is very true. These poor people maybe have nothing to eat. Maybe they have not a home to live in. But they can still be great people when they are spiritually rich. When I pick up a person from the street hungry, I give him a plate of rice, a piece of bread. But a person who is shut out, who feels unwanted, unloved, terrified, the person who has been thrown out of society, that spiritual poverty is much harder to overcome. And abortion, which often follows contraception, brings people to be spiritually poor. And that is the worst poverty and the most difficult to overcome. Those who are materially poor can be very wonderful people. One evening we went out and we picked up four people from the street, and one of them was in most terrible condition. I told the sisters, "You take care of the other three. I will take care of the one who looks worse." So I did for her all that my love could do. I put her in bed, and there was such a beautiful smile on her face. She took hold of my hand, and she said one word only, "Thank you." And she died. I could not help but examine my conscience before her, and I asked, "What would I say if I were in her place?" And my answer was very simple. I would have tried to draw a little attention to myself, and I would have said, "I am hungry, I am dying, I am cold, I am in pain," or something. But she gave me much more. She gave me her grateful love, and she died with a smile on her face. Then there was a man we picked up from the drain, half eaten by worms, and after we had brought him to the home, he only said, "I have lived like an animal in the street, but I am going to die as an angel, loved and cared for." Then after we had removed the worms from his body, all he said with a big smile was, "Sister, I am going home to God." And he died. It was so wonderful to see the greatness of that man, who could speak like that without blaming anybody, without comparing anything. Like an angel, this greatness of people who are spiritually rich, even when they are materially poor. We are not social workers. We may be doing social work in the eyes of some people, but we must be contemplatives in the heart of the world, for we are touching the body of Christ, and we are always in his presence. You too must bring that presence of God into your family, for the family that prays together stays together. There is so much hatred, so much misery, and we with our prayer, with our sacrifice, are beginning at home. Love begins at home. And it is not how much we do, but how much love we put into what we do. If we contemplatives in the heart of the world with all its problems, these problems can never discourage us. We must always remember what God tells us in Scripture. Even if a mother could forget the child in her womb, something impossible, but even if she could forget, "I will never forget you." And so here I am talking to you. I want you to find the poor here, right in your own home first, and begin love there. Be that good news to your own people first, and find out about your next door neighbors. Do you know who they are? I had the most extraordinary experience of love of neighbor with a Hindu family. A gentleman came to our house and said, "Mother Teresa, there is a family who have not eaten for so long. Do you have something?" So I took some rice and went there immediately, and I saw the children, their eyes shining with hunger. I do not know if you have ever seen hunger, but I have seen it very often. And the mother of the family took the rice I gave her and went out. When she came back, I asked her, "Where did you go? What did you do?" And she gave me a very simple answer. "They are hungry also." What struck me was that she knew. And who are they? A Muslim family. And she knew. I didn't bring any more rice that evening because I wanted them, Hindus and Muslims, to enjoy the joy of sharing. It's hard for me to keep reading. It's just so powerful. But I suggest that you go on the internet and find this speech, the speech of Mother Teresa of Calcutta to the National Prayer Breakfast in Washington, February 3rd, 1994. You can find it on the Priests of Life website, where I found it, and read it in honor of Blessed Mother Teresa of Calcutta, who in a few days will be Saint Teresa of Calcutta. All of you are listening, thank you for being there, and in a few moments I'll be back with another guest.
Professor Robert George spoke at the first meeting of the year at the Our Lady of Good Counsel Gospel of Life Group.
Well, I do want to talk with you this evening, as Father said, about something that I know you've all heard people say, and that's the idea that one can be legitimately, reasonably, logically, consistently opposed to the taking of human life in abortion and embryo-destructive research, yet nevertheless pro-choice, respectful of the right of other people to have abortions or to perform deadly experiments on human embryos.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting On the Mind of Christ. That was Princeton's Professor Robert George. On our next program, you'll hear him talk about life and so-called Catholic politicians and their abortion views. He'll unmask their clouded thinking and take questions from the audience. Listen to Putting On the Mind of Christ this Sunday afternoon at 3, encoring Saturday afternoons at 6 on 990 WDEO, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
Why discipline your kids? I'm Dr. Ray Guarendi. Discipline's hard. It takes enormous energy, stamina, resolve. Let them go. It's just easier to let them go. He hammers away at you, crack. You feel guilty sometimes, don't you? Wondering if you're being mean, strict, standards a little too high, afraid of doing something psychologically incorrect. I'll give you a great reason why you discipline him, Mom, Dad. Because you're the best he's ever going to have. You're his mother. You're his father. You love him. He mouths off to you. What do? Oh, you stick him in a chair. Ooh, you're brutal. Fine him a buck. Make him write you a 250-word essay on mouth control. That child's 30 and he mouths off. What happens? He could get beat up. He could get fired. Have to sleep on the couch. The stakes go higher as you get older. That's why we discipline him now. You don't want the world to discipline your child. The world doesn't love your child. The world doesn't have soft landings to its discipline. The world won't hug him and kiss him and love him up and explain it to him after it's all over. Only you will do that. Some employer's not going to go, "You are so cranky. Now, did you get a nap today? We'll go take another one." Discipline is love. It is durable love. It will keep that child from getting battered and bruised the next 60 years at the hands of the world. Do it because you love them. Do it because you're mom and dad.
On the next Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo.
We'll keep you closely connected to the faith with the latest from Rome, the front lines of the pro-life movement, and we'll also take a look at other crucial issues facing you and your family in our one holy Catholic and apostolic church.
Catholic Connection, weekday mornings at 8 a.m. on 990 WDEO.
Is your high schooler paralyzed by the sheer number of potential career paths? Well, join us on today's Homeschool Heartbeat as guest Becky Cook shares one strategy for helping your teen illuminate his or her career plans.
Becky, can you offer any good strategies for high schoolers to match their skills and talents with potential vocations?
Well, yes, Mike. Parents and their teens can talk together on possible volunteer projects, internships, or job shadowing to participate in during high school years. These opportunities will give teens real-life experience in careers they think they want to pursue. For example, my daughter talked about going into a medical field but was unsure whether she wanted to pursue nursing or be a neonatal physician. She approached a neonatologist